Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Wildlife for You podcast. I am your host, Daryl Radijek, and I'm joined by my co-host, Meg. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Meg Pelly in Tennessee, just outside the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Yeah, so we got North America covered. We got Meg in the East, and I'm in the West. I'm in Utah. I'm a career wildlife biologist that have been... I've been teaching this wildlife education, this Wildlife for You platform for about 5 years now. But we do a podcast occasionally and classes and lots of other things. So we could talk more about that towards the end of the show. But for today's show, what we're thinking of doing, when Meg and I reinitiated the podcast, because just so you know, folks, this podcast was, we did about 80 episodes with myself and another great friend of mine, great biologist, Stephanie Payne. But life got in her way and she started a new job and a new house. And so Meg has picked up the reins. And when we first started doing this, we focused a lot in the Southeast because that's where Meg is most familiar. And we talk about Great Smoky Mountain National Park quite a bit because it's one of our favorite areas. I used to work just outside of the Smokies with black bears, and Meg is in the park as much as she can nowadays. And so we do talk quite a bit about that. And one of the first episodes that Meg and I did probably 2-3 months ago, we were kind of just talking about wildlife that you find within the park. And we mentioned all different species from mammals to birds to you name it. And one of the species we mentioned is a little, well, it's not a little animal. It's one of the bigger animals that people often talk about. And we mentioned red wolves. Now, I will tell you right now that red wolves are not found within the park. But recently, there's been quite a bit of discussion and banter. You know, Facebook, social media is just chock full of really bad information sometimes. There's a lot of folks that are thinking and believing that red wolves still live in and around Great Smoky Mountain National Park. And we are going to spend today's episode talking about red wolves. So I want to kick it off because I know Meg is in that area quite a bit. Do you get any questions regarding red wolves or not too much?
I don't get a whole lot so people understand. I volunteer in the park at the visitor center. So I answer all kinds of questions. I don't get a whole lot about red wolves. I've gotten a few and some people have been aware that the park tried to reintroduce them into that area, and they have come in and asked me questions about that, which we're going to talk about a little bit today. But I've never had anybody come in and say they saw one in the park or anywhere, actually.
And again, this is kind of a product of today's world, which is social media. And I keep tabs on a lot of stuff, and it's probably it's a bad characteristic of me that I pay so much attention to social media, because one of the things that I really can't stand is the perpetuation of misinformation. When people say things that are completely untrue, and then you see all these people asking them questions and like, oh, I didn't know that. And I'm usually jumping in on the back end looking like the idiot bad guy because I'm refuting what they're saying. But I will continue to do that as long as I'm breathing, because I want people to have good information. And so recently, it was probably about 2 weeks ago, there was a discussion, and it centered around a lot of folks that hike in the Smokies, and they started talking about the wolves. And I was like, what wolves? And reading more and more, they were talking about, there's wolves, red wolves in that area in East Tennessee, Western North Carolina. And so I joined that discussion. So today what we're going to do, we're going to talk about a little known species that is in North America. It's kind of a sad story, but to kick things off, I'm going to quiz you, Meg. How many species of wolves are found in North America?
too.
See, you are my shining star pupil. you must have been listening to me for a while. Yes, very, very good. There's a lot of folks that think there's all these different kinds of wolves, but believe it or not, there's only two different species of wolves in North America. The first one is the gray wolf, Canis lupus, and that was pretty widespread. It was found all the way down to Mexico, to the northern parts of Canada, and it goes by many names, the gray wolf, timber wolf. You probably even heard people talking about Mexican wolves down in New Mexico, Arizona area. Even those are gray wolves. They're just kind of a southern grouping of gray wolves. And so gray wolves predominantly roam over North America. Historically, and for hundreds and hundreds or thousands of years, the Southeast was predominantly occupied by this species called red wolves, and it's Canis rufus. So it is a different kind of species. And those pretty much, they are wolves. They almost look like a cross between a wolf and a coyote. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit smaller. They tend to be a little bit smaller than gray wolves, but for the most part, they occupied the entire Southeast. And those were the wolves that were here until my arch nemesis, the early Europeans, came over and started wiping all the animals out. So I resolved my issues with the early Europeans, but they didn't do good things for wildlife or with wildlife.
Oh, yeah.
And so pretty much anything that competed with the new humans that came to North America, we exploited them. We saw them as competition. Some of the animals like deer and elk and turkey, we saw them as food sources, and we just pretty much wiped them out from most of their historic range. Sadly, we started wiping out red wolves in the Southeast. And it got so bad, Meg, that we finally, when the Endangered Species Act came along in the early 1970s, we pretty much knew that the red wolves were really in trouble. And so they started looking to find where there were red wolves remaining in the Southeast. And you know where they found them? I don't know if you've read too much about the history, but it was the last place that red wolves were hanging on in the early 1970s. You know where that was?
I don't know that answer.
You don't? Okay. Well,
I can guess.
Take a guess.
I don't know. Maybe in North Carolina. I know that's
very good guess. But believe it or not, the remaining wolf population in the early 70s was predominantly right along the Louisiana-Texas border, right along the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
Heavy bayou, swampy area. And that pretty much where animals hang on is where people don't like going. And so they found a population of these red wolves, and they started capturing some because they thought that those were pretty much the only red wolves that they were finding in North America. And so a lot of those were put into like zoo facilities, breeding facilities, because they were trying to save whatever was left of that species of red wolf. And sadly, they did that from like 1973 to 1980, and they could not find any more. They were officially, believe it or not, they were officially declared extinct by 1980. Extinct, I shouldn't say extinct, period. I should say extinct in the wild. Could not find any more red wolves in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they realized was a big problem. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service, and if you see me looking over at all, if you want to learn about red wolves, just look up the Red Wolf Recovery Program from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Please don't look up red wolves from Jim Bob Paul's like blog, because you want to get some really, really good up-to-date information from folks that are studying these things. anyway, the Fish and Wildlife Service really took note. They are listed as an endangered species, and they started this Red Wolf Recovery Program. And what they're going to do is try to restore red wolves in the Southeast by using some of those captive animals and hopefully reestablish that population. Now, your guess before of North Carolina was a really good guess simply because it's really good habitat there. And so one of the places that they started releasing and trying to restore the population was coastal North Carolina. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But little do people know when it comes to the Smokies. Do you remember this at all? But the Smokies had a Red Wolf Recovery Program that they were trying to restore red wolves into the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. Do you remember any of that?
You know, unfortunately, I did not. I had moved out of the state of Tennessee during that time and was gone during that period and have moved back, obviously. So I was not aware of that program until after it had already happened when I moved back into the state of Tennessee after it was already over. So
that's why we make such a good team, because when you moved away, I moved in.
You were here. That's right.
I had moved to East Tennessee, just outside of Great Smoky Mountain National Park in 1997 to begin my career as a wildlife biologist. And I was working with bears, but that was the tail end of the Red Wolf program in the Smokies. And I do have a little bit more intimate knowledge of the program. I spoke to one of the lead biologists on that project, Chris Lukash, and I'll tell you a couple stories about that. But I shouldn't say myself, but the Bear Center I worked at, the Appalachian Bear Center, which is mm-hmm. now a bear rescue, mm-hmm. we were struggling with money, and we wanted to find out what we were doing was actually working. And after they abandoned the Red Wolf program, they had a whole bunch of these collars, which were designed for red wolves, which are smaller animals, probably about 30, 40 pounds. Mm-hmm. And they actually gave me those red wolf collars to put on orphan bear cubs when we were releasing them. So that is my connection with the Red Wolf program.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the National Park Service in the early 90s began this recovery program and trying to restore red wolves to that area. And a bunch of releases took place. The Cades Cove area was a prime spot for mm-hmm. a lot of that. And they tried for a number of years. And unfortunately, that program was unsuccessful. They released a number of adults, and all the adults that they were putting out there had radio collars on them, tags. They were numbered. And so they knew which ones were red wolves. And unfortunately, like, there was reproduction happening, but they weren't surviving. The something was always happening to the litter of pups. And it was, I don't know if it was just like a string of bad luck, but for example, like, they had a situation where parvo virus went through and wiped out a litter of pups. Then there's another litter that was just overwhelmed by parasites. Believe it or not, they actually had a litter of pups that they believe was preyed upon by a black bear. And so they were just having no luck with these red wolves reproducing and raising young successfully. Now, there's also issues because, you know as well as I, there's another canine in that area that people see all the time, and that yep. is?
The coyote.
The coyote. And with the red wolves and coyotes, what you have to understand, folks, lots of times you will hear people talk about animals interbreeding or crossbreeding and mixing. You hear people talk about coy dogs all the time. Those things don't happen much. The reason different species will tend to interbreed is when there's not many of one species. They have a hard time finding mates because there's not many of their own kind. And that's when they typically cross over and mate with a very similar species. And so with the Red Wolf program, there was only a handful of red wolves in that area and a whole bunch of coyotes. And so the red wolves, if they were having problems finding mates, they would tend to try to mix with the coyotes. And the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't want any of that happening. So unfortunately, that project was abandoned. And 1997, 1998, they rounded up all the red wolves that were involved in that program, and they shipped them to coastal North Carolina, the east coast of North Carolina, to a place called Alligator River National Refuge. And that, sadly, folks, is where the only remaining red wolves in North America survive right now. So, I've been talking a lot, just giving you a brief history here, but do you have like any questions or anything that I could answer that could lead into anything? Cause I could ramble on for hours, but I want to give you.
Well, you're probably going to talk about this in a few moments. So I don't want to get ahead of what you plan to say, but
you just leave me wherever you want to go, Meg.
Okay. So there are several places around the nation that are that have red wolves in captivity that they're trying to breed. But there are some also being released into the wild. And, you know, I've read about it. You and I have talked a little bit about it, but maybe we share with others that, you know, what are those numbers like that are being released into the wild? Are they being successful with their releases back into the wild? And then how many of these breeding facilities are there? And they're not all located in the Southeast. And, and this is a little side note to that, that I thought was fascinating is the red wolves are original to the United States and especially to the Southeast because their habitat was Pennsylvania down to Florida, over to the coast of Texas, all of that, kind of swap through the Southeast and the East Coast before they started losing ground, before their pelts became very popular with the Europeans. And being a teacher, all of those fairy tales that they taught the kids in Europe, who was the bad guy? Yes. And so they came over here and saw these wolves and like, ooh, we're afraid of those. That's bad. That helped wipe that whole population out for no good reason, which...
Yeah.
It's amazing to me, but I just thought it was interesting that these breeding centers are not necessarily in the areas that are native to these red wolves, so I'll let you address that.
That's a fantastic question, because when I told you, like, back in the late 70s all the way up to 1980, they were trying to find where the red wolves were existing in the wild, and they caught some and they put them in these facilities. And so these zoo-like facilities, captive breeding facilities. And one of the things you want to make sure of is to maintain like the pure genetics of the red wolf. You don't want that red wolf mixing with coyote or domestic dog or anything. Mm-hmm. You want to keep the pure genetics. So there's literally just a handful, well, I don't know the exact number, but there's certain captive breeding facilities that are like accredited red wolf facilities. They call them red wolf safe facilities. And so, if you look at the Fish and Wildlife Service website, it's got amazing information about all of this. But currently, there's about 260, 270 animals or red wolves that are pure red wolves that are scattered about in these different captive breeding facilities. And like you said, some of them aren't even in their current range, but they're all over North America because zoos can do a wonderful thing of teaching people about wildlife. I'm not a big zoo person because I hate seeing animals behind bars, but they do serve a purpose. And one of the best purposes is as a breeding facility to maintain a population. And so there's a number of red wolves scattered about North America in these captive breeding facilities. A lot of times what they'll do is they will try when they're trying to restore that population. Like, for example, when they were doing it in the Smokies or in coastal North Carolina, they want to maintain a lot of genetic diversity. So they'll get unrelated animals from different locations and use them. They'll obviously take males and females and use them to hopefully kickstart or augment or just keep those wild wolf populations going. I will tell you, the wolves in coastal North Carolina, where present day, that's the only place they survive in the wild, they were doing really, really well all the way up until 2012, I believe. It was estimated there was about 120 red wolves in that area. And through a series of unfortunate events, they had hurricanes, they had just bad luck, kind of like the whole Smokies project, and their population crashed. And it got down to where there was, I believe a year or two ago, is only about a dozen individuals. And they've been working, the Fish and Wildlife Service has kickstarted that Red Wolf recovery program, putting more focus on it. Now, because you don't want a species to blink out if you have an opportunity to do something about it.
Right. So,
right now they're estimating, and in fact, if you read that website, they just reintroduced another male and a female. June 7th, which was only a couple months ago, they spotted that the male and female with a litter of pups. There's, believe it or not, there is five pups born to the wild. And what they do with a lot of these wolf recovery programs, and I could even talk about some of the Mexican wolf stuff, but what they'll do is, it's kind of what we did with the Bear Center. When you find a female that has just given birth to a litter of wolf pups or bear cubs, and you have an orphan, or you have one that you want to release to the wild that's of similar age, it's so much better if they're raised in the wild instead of being raised in captive and then releasing them when they're adult, because they learn a whole lot more when they're out there at a very, very young age. And so anyway, just recently, within the last 2 months, a new litter of red wolf pups was spotted. So they had five original, and they added a little baby wolf pup from one of those captive facilities, and they're, cross your fingers, are still doing pretty good now. So again, if you ever want to go, Alligator River National Refuge, it's the only place in the world where you can see a red wolf in the wild.
That's pretty neat. So I had read, you were talking about keeping the genetics pure, and when they found the original red wolf population down around Louisiana in the 70s, I had read there was only about 14. And so the genetics from those 14 red wolves were pure, and that's what is being passed down. Is that true?
Here's the thing, Meg. When it comes to canine genetics, it's a melting pot. There's pretty much no such thing as 100% pure wolf or 100% pure coyote. Pretty much every canine, even like domestic dogs, coyotes, wolves, it's declared a wolf because most of the genetics are wolf. It might be 93% wolf, 5% this, and 2% that. And so, like, oh my gosh, we can talk forever because it's so misunderstood. People talk about coy wolves all the time. And they're talking about these larger, believe it or not, coy wolves, it was a term, I wish they never coined it, but a coy wolf is not that direct 50-50 cross between a coyote and a wolf. A coy wolf terminology now, it is a coyote. It's a coyote that has a little bit more wolf genes, because in the early 1900s, some of the wolves up around Algonquin Provincial Park up in Canada mated with some coyotes. And so it's all in the Northeast. So when you hear about coy wolves in the Northeast, they're just a little bit larger coyote because they're mostly coyote, but they do have a little bit more wolf genetics in it. And so there's so much confusion in the canine world about all these mixes. A lot of people think there are 50-50 mixes out there, and that's rarely ever the case. Can I bring up something? You briefly mentioned it, and I made a mental note to bring it back up. Telling the difference between a coyote and a red wolf, do you know how to do that? Or do you think you'd be able to do that?
The one wearing the collar is the red wolf. Obviously, I've never seen a red wolf in person, but in looking at pictures.
Doesn't the Knoxville Zoo have red wolves?
They may have. I just haven't been to see
them. Yeah, I think they got
a... You know? So, but there are some facial features on a red wolf that are different from, you know, they don't look exactly like a coyote through the face. It's almost like they have a little, I don't know, they have a little thing around their eyes.
Yeah, and their snout is, usually coyotes have real narrow snouts.
Yeah.
And wolves have a much broader muzzle to them. Yeah. And so there are those subtle differences. And I will tell you, when it comes to like telling what species is which, there's an art to it as well. And the reason I'm saying this is a lot of times, even telling the difference between black bears and grizzlies can be very, very difficult at times when you only have a single picture or you could have brown or red looking black bears. And so there is an art form to it. Telling the difference between a coyote and a red wolf, you have to be a major artist because they can be very similar. Like I said, the red wolf looks kind of like a cross between a gray wolf and a coyote. But a funny story I mentioned when I was working in Tennessee, I was at the tail end of the Red Wolf Project, and I was talking to one of the lead biologists there, Chris Lukash, and I asked him, I said, Chris, I don't know much about wolves. I've never had any experience with wolves. How do you tell the difference between a red wolf and a coyote? And he goes into this long spiel about, okay, if you see the two, get out your binoculars and you have to wait until they turn away from you. And then as they're walking away, you look at the gate. And when both animals look back at you, the one that has the radio collar on it is the red wolf. Like, you could have told me that right off the bat, but he was trying to tell me that they're very similar. Even the pros who work with these animals really have to examine them very, very closely before they can make an educated guess. And so that kind of is what gets to me on some of these social media, because people who live up in the mountains will say, oh, I just saw a red wolf a couple months ago. It ran across. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. It was pitch black. So they always see these fantastical creatures at 2 o'clock in the morning running across the road. Anyway, a lot of people will swear they saw a red wolf, which, again, if the professionals working with them have a hard time discerning them, there's a really good chance you might just be looking at a coyote.
So aren't red wolves a little more elusive than coyotes are? Because, like, we have coyotes in my backyard. About this time every night, they're having a powwow in my backyard and you hear them. And it wouldn't surprise me if we don't hear them in a minute. But aren't red wolves a little more elusive than a coyote? You know, how likely are you to see a red wolf?
Yeah, I would say that coyotes are definitely more adapted to being around humans. And so the likelihood of you seeing coyotes, I will say that many animals, including coyotes, wolves, bears, they can become habituated. And so, in fact, when I was reading the Fish and Wildlife Service website the other day, they had taken one of the captive red wolves and they're trying to release it into the wild. But because it was raised in captivity, it just did not have that wild spirit. And it mm-hmm. kept showing up in places where they really didn't want it showing mm-hmm. up. So they ended up recapturing that, putting it back into another captive breeding facility, because, again, the genetics are really good. But when it comes to wild behaviors, it's always best if that animal is raised in the wild. They mm-hmm. survive so much better. And the main reason is they're afraid of humans. When they're born in the wild, they don't like these two-legged, naked creatures coming up towards them.
So right.
That's what keeps them safe, is when they keep that wariness of humans. So.
Yeah. So how successful do you think this breeding program and this releasing of them in, you know, as we've said, they're only in North Carolina right now on the coast. You know, what do you think the chances of this being successful, bar any major coastal storms again?
It's funny you ask me that, because I'm getting ready to to ask biology in my day job as a wildlife biologist. I want to talk to some folks that have done some bison work, and that's my final question I'm asking is, all right, you're looking into a crystal ball, and what do you see in regards to bison 50 years from now, 20 years from now? And so you just turned the tables on me.
That's what you hired me for, isn't it?
Yes. I want you to ask me the tough questions. I don't like being a Debbie Downer. I always want to believe that we can do anything we put our minds to. I just believe the Red Wolves have too much working against them. And the big thing there is, I think the reason they're always going to struggle is because of this influx of coyotes from, besides humans, like, not liking wolves for the most part. Unfortunately, we were raised as little boys and girls to be afraid of the big bad wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this stigmatism out there about wolves, and there's a lot of folks that don't want wolves in their backyard. If we could get over that hump, the thing that's really hurting the Red Wolves is this influx of coyotes that have now spread across North America. Because hundreds of years ago, when the Red Wolves were running all over the Southeast, there were no coyotes in the Southeast. It was just pretty much Red Wolf. The predominant canine in the Southeast was the Red Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And so a Red Wolf bred with a Red Wolf bred with a Red Wolf. But now you had this really tiny population of Red Wolves, and you put it out there, and there's this ocean of coyotes that are out there. And unfortunately, Red Wolves may struggle to find mates. And then you start getting this mixing. When there's too few of animals of one species, you tend to get that interbreeding happening. And that's mm-hmm. not good for the Red Wolf species, because it dilutes their genetics.
Yeah.
Hmm. So as to what's going to happen, I think we'll keep them alive as a species, but whether or not they have large expanses of roaming free and wild, I don't foresee that happening.
Mm.
Now, I will tell you, I mentioned coastal North Carolina as the only place that has free-ranging red wolf population. But what was interesting to me, and I was so confused, because we talked about these captive breeding programs. One of them is off the coast of Texas, I believe, the St. Vincent Refuge. Have you read anything about that or no?
I haven't read anything about that one.
Well, that's one of the areas. It's close to their last remnant population. And it's classified as a captive breeding facility because it's got the pure Red Wolf genes, but it's an island off the coast. And so the wolves there kind of roam, they can't go anywhere. But those are usually really good candidates because they're more or less surviving on their own in the wild, although they're captive because they're captive on this island.
Right. But nothing, but nothing can interbreed with them. There's no coyotes on that, right? Yes. Yeah.
And so those animals often are one of the top choices when it comes to putting more red wolves in the wild, because they're kind of being raised. It's not like they're being raised on concrete in a cage somewhere.
Right.
So
that sounds like a science fiction book in the making.
Like a Jurassic Park.
Yeah. You know, I'm just sitting here thinking, we could write that book.
So, well, hopefully, if I'd feel so bad when I dominate the conversation, but
no,
you get me on a topic I love, and I love the predators. But if you're working or volunteering or just out and about in the park, and someone asks you about red wolves, hopefully you'll have a little bit more information to throw at them.
Yep. And you know, as I said, I've had a few people ask me, and you and I just personally have had this discussion before. And so, you know, I kind of need to tell them it didn't work. And here's why. But it's always good to get more information. More knowledge you have, the better you can help.
Yeah, just don't go by what I say. I keep looking over that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service webpage. Let me read the title of it, but it's the Red Wolf Recovery Program. Those guys are the leading experts. All the history, where these animals came from, how they're raised, the captive facilities, the wild reintroductions, they keep it really up to date too. And so
they're
the true professionals that know all there is about the red wolf. Not so much the folks on social media that saw them crossing in front of their car at 2 a.m. So
yeah, and you know, do coyotes and red wolves sound alike?
Well, I both are amazing to hear. I love, a lot of people don't like the sound of coyotes. Coyotes kind of, a coyote's nickname, have you ever heard the term song dog?
Song dog?
Yeah. Coyotes are nicknamed song dogs because they're constantly yipping and making lots of vocalizations. And they don't have that true deep howl of a wolf, especially the gray wolf. They're more yippy.
Yeah.
But they'll get to really singing at times. And like I said, I love hearing coyotes. Wolves tend to have more of that single vocalization, that lone wolf type of howl, which I think is just one of the greatest sounds in the world.
So. Yeah. As I said, I have coyotes in my backyard. And they're usually about this time every evening, they start their yipping, and then you feel like it's almost a howl, but not quite a howl. And then I go looking to make sure all my cats are in the house. Because we've lost.
Once they hear them, they're probably clamoring to get back in.
Oh, yeah, they are. They show up at the door real quick.
Well, I will tell you, you just reminded me something when we're talking about that wolf howl. One of the greatest things that I ever experienced when I was working at the Bear Center in East Tennessee, late 1990s, there was an amazing wildlife educator. She is a veterinarian. Did you ever hear of Marcella Cranford?
Mm-mm.
She was one of the early board members. She was a very popular figure around Knoxville in the wildlife realm. And Marcella was on the board of directors for the Bear Center when I first started working there. And, one of the things, she was a huge proponent for wolves, gray wolves, purebred gray wolves, none of these hybrids. And she was one of the few people permitted in the state to have pure strain gray wolves. And she used them for educational purposes. And so she would give a lot of talks at area schools and whatnot. And one of the greatest phone calls I ever received, Marcella, out of the blue, I'm sitting at the Bear Center and the phone rings and it is Marcella. And she's like, Daryl, can I ask a huge favor of you? She's like, one of my female wolves had pups a few months ago. And we're trying to get them acclimated to humans because we use these for educational purposes. We take them to schools and we just got to make sure they're comfortable being around people. She goes, all my volunteers are women. They have no experience. These wolves had no experience being around a male human figure. And she's like, would you come over and play with the wolves for a little bit? I was like, shh. We were still on the phone and I was knocking on her door. So I tell you what, these were sub-adult. They were only, I think, like 4 or 5 months old, but they were already, I remember the one jumped up and put its paws on my shoulders and it was almost knocking me over. And I'm not the smallest of guys, but I just could not imagine that it was such a powerful animal. And it was so cool. Like she obviously was in there with me to keep them from doing too much, too many things that they weren't supposed to.
Yeah.
But to be able to get in there and just feel the power of a true gray wolf was absolutely fascinating. So
yeah, yeah, and obviously they are much larger than the red wolves that we've been talking about. Yeah.
Yes, typically. Now, one of the things that's really interesting with the wolves, because I mentioned gray wolves pretty much roam most of North America except that southeast. And so you're talking a huge north and south range, all the way from the northern tip of Alaska and Canada, all the way down to Mexico and well down into Mexico. And so whenever you have a species that has such a wide north to south range, there's tremendous differences in some of the physical characteristics. So we talked about this, I think before the show, but if you're living near the equator or Mexico, do you want to be a big bulky wolf or would you want to be like real skinny and gangly?
Yeah, I want to be on the thinner side and yeah.
Well, there's, can I put on, I'm going to put on my nerd glasses. I'm going to teach you about,
what?
I'm going to teach you about, there's two, this is really getting nerdy biology in me, but there's two rules when it comes to that north and south development of animals. And so have you ever heard of Bergman's rule?
Bergman's rule?
B-E-R-G.
Oh, Bergman's. No.
Bergman's rule is, it's just a rule of thumb. It doesn't hold true for everything, but a general rule of thumb is the more northern you go, the stockier and shorter limbs you have, like the bulkier you are. So Think of a big fat old grizzly bear up in Alaska. They can be really short, stocky, and rotund.
Mm-hmm.
You get, well, I should have said a black bear. But a black bear way down in Mexico or southern New Mexico, Arizona, they're not going to be big, fat, rotund. They're pretty skinny and gangly. And so Bergman's rule says the further north you go, the stockier you are. So I must have been born in the North Pole. That's me right now. So that's Bergman's rule. The other thing is called Allen's rule, like Josh Allen, the best quarterback in the NFL. So Allen's rule is, I saw that. Allen's rule is, again, it's that north-south stuff. And so the further south you go, the longer your appendages, because a lot of it has to do with your body's ability to give off heat, to thermoregulate. And so you're usually like longer appendages, skinnier in the southern reaches, and in the northern reaches, you tend to be bulkier, shorter armed. And it's all about conserving heat up in the north or dissipating heat in the south. So how about that for nerdology there?
Well, you know, you observe those things in nature. I mean, if you're paying any attention to wildlife around the world, you've already noticed that, picked that up and seen it. I just didn't know that it was named after some men.
Yeah, and again, it's just general rule of thumb. And one of the right. cool things, like with that Allen's rule with the appendages, there are some like foxes, swift foxes in the desert southwest. And if you look at their ears are like super long
yeah.
and
yeah,
and it's meant to dissipate heat so they don't overheat. So mm-hmm. pretty amazing stuff when it comes to how animals survive.
That's so. Pretty neat.
So would you believe we went this whole episode without me mentioning like the whole bear hibernation? I sent you some.
Yeah.
So I gotta go back to that because misinformation being yeah. spread like wildfire
yeah.
is not good. So going back to the red wolves, anything else we didn't cover or talk about or?
I think we've covered everything that I.
The bottom line. I made a list. Yeah, the bottom line is there are no, like, if you go visit the Smokies or anywhere else in the Southeast, unless you are on the coast of North Carolina and in or around Alligator River National Refuge, now that, like, that surrounding periphery, obviously there's a likelihood. Yeah. But if you're anywhere 100 miles from there,
yeah,
you're probably not. I have to use probably because there's no absolutes, but it's about as close to absolute as we can get.
Yeah. You know, you and I talked about this a little bit before we started this thing. We both wish that the Red Wolves had made it and yeah. had been successful because, you know, what a magnificent animal to be able to see in the wild.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is kind of a sad thing that their chances of repopulating are not great. That's kind of a sad thing, but
that would have been my crystal ball, but I just think they,
yeah,
they have far more of a struggle. Let me add to that, because obviously there's gray wolf populations that have been reintroduced in Greater Yellowstone. That was back in 1998, I believe, the first release. I forget when that was, but it is only about 20, 25 years ago. And they have done tremendously well. And in fact, would you believe, I was just reading today, that there's wolves, that there's three big populations, not big population, but distinct populations of wolves in the lower 48. You have those Mexican wolves down in Arizona and New Mexico. And there's about 160, 180 now. They might have hit 200. But then there's a population in the Western Great Lakes states. So Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Minnesota, that area, the wolves there are doing pretty good. But then that Yellowstone population, when those were released, they've done tremendously well. They've grown and expanded from Yellowstone National Park all the way up into Montana, Idaho, Wyoming. They spread all the way over to Washington. And what I was just reading today, California now has 4 packs of gray wolves that they're monitoring. And so when it comes to the ability of wolves to live in the wild and repopulate and grow in numbers, there's hope there because gray wolves are doing just that. The reason the red wolves, again, has this knock against them, besides the coyote issue I mentioned, where are the red wolves historically found?
They're along the coast.
Yeah, and in the southeast.
And
where's most of the population of the U.S. is?
Not on the coast.
No. It's in the eastern half of the U.S. And so wolves really do best when they don't encounter many humans mm-hmm. and they have the opportunity to do that in the West where they're taken off. But the red wolf, unfortunately, they're going to have issues with humans all the time.
You know, I don't know. I'm just throwing this out there. Could they not release them somewhere out west where the population is not as dense? And would they have a chance to survive? I mean, it's interesting to me that they their original habitat stayed in the southeast and along the eastern coast and didn't spread out west. And same thing with the gray wolves. They haven't spread into the southeast.
Right.
You know, but...
Well, that is a wonderful question. And this is one of those... Hindsight is 2020, because as humans, once we realized we were wiping out all the animals and we wanted to do something good, lots of the state wildlife agencies were taking animals to reintroduce them into the wild to restore their populations after we wiped them out. And a lot of times we took animals that weren't native to those areas and we released. Would you believe, and this just popped in my head, even Tennessee took mule deer, or they purchased mule deer from, or this was back, I think, in the early 70s, and they brought mule deer to try to populate Tennessee with mule deer. Those didn't survive. Believe it or not, those were released down in Chattanooga. It was kind of like an experiment. They didn't survive because the Western mule deer did not know how to survive the brain worm that was found in the East. Uh-huh. And so we did that quite a bit. There's been in New Mexico, there's like ibex, which is from Northern Africa, I believe.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different, Texas is just a big zoo. Texas has released every kind of animal. Yeah. I don't like Texas for that reason, but anyway,
sorry if you're from
what
Texas.
We realized is it's not a good idea to put animals in an area where they're not native.
Right.
Two things happen. Like, for example, that case of mule deer, those mule deer could not survive some of the parasites. And so those mule deer perished. But sometimes the animals will survive. And when they do survive, they often outcompete the native animals. Mm. And so that's why you don't want to take red wolves and you think, ooh, the West might be good because there's fewer people and maybe not as many coyotes and maybe they do well. You don't really know the repercussions. And in most cases, the repercussions are not positive. And so, like I said, hindsight's 2020. We did this quite a bit throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And we put not only animal like mammals, but fish in places where they don't belong. And so, like, you know, rainbow trout that are found everywhere, they're not native to the East.
Right.
You know where rainbow trout are native to?
I'm looking at Texas.
Just blame it on Texas.
Just blame it on Texas.
No, but
they're not native to the Smokies, I know. And
right.
they're really
the
pushing
Northwest.
Out the... Yeah.
And so, like, they're a really popular game fish. But so everybody started releasing rainbow trout. And now they're pretty much throughout North America, but they outcompete a lot of the native trout. So, like, in the Smokies, the brook trout. Those are the native fish in those mountains. And they're having a real hard time hanging on because these other fish were introduced to that area.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, really good thought. And we tried that, and what we found out is a lot of times when you introduce an animal to a place it's never been, it usually doesn't work out for the better. Either that animal doesn't make it, or the native animals suffer.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, there goes my plan.
I would give you credit, but I'm trying to save you from getting a black eye. So. So anyway, well, folks, we hope you learned a little bit about red wolves. Beautiful, beautiful animal. Look them up. Again, go to the Fish and Wildlife Service. They are the leading experts when it comes to red wolves and red wolf recovery. They're not found in many places other than that coastal North Carolina and obviously some of these captive breeding facilities. But if you do get a chance to see them in a zoo, go ahead and take a look at them because they're beautiful animals. But unfortunately, they're really struggling in the wild right now. So with that, Meg, I don't think we're going to do another podcast for about 3 weeks. We got plans in another week or so.
It's coming up fast. Like, it just dawned on me today. It's just a little over a week.
Yes, and what we're referring to, folks, is one of the side adventures for this Wildlife for You platform. Because we love teaching about wildlife, usually once a year, I might try it twice next year. I might do a spring and a fall, but it's a week-long trip where folks that are really interested in learning about wildlife, I call it the Green Fire Tour. So Wildlife for You sponsors this Green Fire Tour where it's a vacation for you, but it's a working, learning, relaxing vacation because we take you to some pretty wild and beautiful places and you get an earful of me talking
about
wildlife and ecosystems. So anyway, Meg is going to be joining us for the third year, not in a row because we took the COVID year off, but third time Meg will be joining us.
Didn't we go in 2020?
Oh yeah, it was the COVID year, but then I skipped a year. I skipped a year because I moved. Yeah, because I was in between places. I was staying with my in-laws. Anyway, we call it the Green Fire Tour in honor of Aldo Leopold, and I'll tell everyone that story of why it's called the Green Fire Tour. But if you want to learn more about Wildlife for You and all the stuff we talk about regarding wildlife, again, I favor predators because they're my favorite group of animals, but I love all animals just the same. So anyway, with that, I believe we'll sign off. We're almost at an hour. And so thank you for joining us. And Meg, thank you for talking about red wolves with me and bringing some questions for me to answer.
It's always, always, always a pleasure. I look forward to this every couple of weeks and can't wait to get out there and go exploring with you.
Yep. It'll be fun. I'm going one more place this weekend, but I got that special treat for you. Everyone will have to wait to hear about it. So.
Okay.
All right. Signing off, folks. We'll see you next time.
Good evening.